Welcome. I'm Angie Coiro, and this is Your Call. Rose Aguilar is out today. It's April 15th. Happy Tax Day, if there is such a thing. Wouldn't it be nice to be exempt from paying that annual chunk of money to the federal government? Churches and other religious groups are, to a large extent, Giving USA reports that in 2021, Americans donated more than $135 billion to churches and religious organizations. None of that was taxed, not locally, on a state level, or federal level. Here's a bit of history. The Tax Defense Network says American churches have always been exempt, with that status made official in 1891. No taxes on income or property. In 1954, the Johnson Amendment was added to the federal tax code. It barred those entities from participating in political campaigns at the cost of losing their tax breaks. Oddly, that was not controversial at all until the 21st century, and then the groups involved claimed the Johnson Amendment impinged on their freedom of speech. Donald Trump signed a largely symbolic executive order forbidding the amendment's enforcement, but it's still on the books. There are two things to consider about that. It was already being widely ignored, and now Trump and Elon Musk have the IRS staff in their sights for more and serious staff reductions. CNBC says some 6,000 to 7,000 workers are already gone. Who's next out of the 90,000 remaining employees depends on who's reporting it. Some say 25% will be cut, while the AP puts it as high as 50% of the roster. Right now, we'll get an update on the IRS layoffs and their capacity to enforce the laws on the books. Then we'll spend the balance of the hour looking specifically at the religious exemptions. Let me welcome Spencer Woodman. He has extensive experience covering the IRS. He's an award-winning reporter for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the ICIJ. It's based in New York. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, NBC News, the AP, the Guardian, Rolling Stone, and The Intercept. His recent pieces focusing on the IRS are online at icij.org. Spencer, we're so glad to have you. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
Oh, before we get to the religious exemptions in the latter part of the hour, in the wider picture, who does the IRS zero in on to look for red flags?
Well, it's it kind of depends what, you know, what era you're looking at. So under President Biden, there was a big effort to strengthen the IRS's capabilities to enforce tax law on ultra wealthy people. Billionaires and other ultra wealthy people are known to commit a far outsized share of tax evasion. Some people put this estimate at like 30% of all taxes evaded in the United States are done by the top 1% of taxpayers, the taxpayers in that top 1% bracket. Mm-hmm. This is partially because they have the ability to hire high-end accountants and white shoe tax attorneys to construct very complex tax evasion structures that the IRS has historically had a lot of trouble taking apart. Under Biden, there was the Inflation Reduction Act that gave the IRS $80 billion additional dollars to kind of hire a lot of experts and strengthen their ability to untangle these tax structures deployed by the ultra wealthy. Over the past few years, Republicans have succeeded in clawing back about half of that $80 billion. We can go into the kind of recent layoffs in a second. The deployment of the new money, we've seen some results and also some real challenges, that I'm also happy to go into in some more detail.
Yeah, and I want to get to that in detail. First, I want to look at this tax evasion by the 1%, the percentage of the 1%. Are we talking about the IRS not looking at fraud with the understanding you're not a lawyer? But are we looking at legitimate exemptions that we ought to be looking for to reform? Are we looking at actual fraud, or are we looking at a combination of both? Do we know?
Well, it's both. And, you know, the IRS is put, especially with high-end enforcement, they're put in this very unfortunate position of having to deal with very bad tax laws. So, you know, there are very few people who think that Congress shouldn't step in and make things more simple and close a lot of loopholes. But, you know, with what the IRS has been given, this bad situation, this bad hand they've been dealt, you know, there are ways they could improve, even if you know, even despite the kind of lacking resources and the money situation, according to a lot of you know agents and other people I've spoken with close to the agency. You know, the reporting I did last year, which was largely done under the Biden administration, on how the this historic overhaul of the agency was going, there were a lot of people in the agency and who had recently departed the agency that were concerned that the office that polices billionaires and large corporations just kind of even despite having a lot of new money thrown at it, had some issues, had some you know a you know the overall view was that they were taking a lighter approach to ultra wealthy taxpayers than the offices in the IRS that tax that police you know normal regular individuals. So this even manifested in a you know set of rules for agents that police ultra wealthy taxpayers and large corporations that are much more restrictive in terms of what they can do, in terms of how they can demand information from these taxpayers, than compared with agents who audit regular taxpayers. And then just this kind of overall culture of timidity in terms of referring possible crimes among corporations and billionaires during the audit process to criminal investigators. This is something that IRS agents who audit small businesses do quite regularly, and it is very rare to see these criminal referrals come out of the large business and billionaires division of the IRS.
F. Scott Fitzgerald, the rich are different from you and me. Let's talk about what enforcement looks like if it does happen. Do you have any cases in mind, or can you point to any where there actually was enforcement on the most rich and the most well-endowed corporations?
Well, you know, it's been a little while. There was a probably one of the highest profile recent cases was litigation the IRS entered into against Caterpillar, which had, you know, the big manufacturing and construction equipment company. That case involved that company having shifted a bunch of income to Swiss entities and all of this kind of complex offshore alleged tax evasion. You know, Caterpillar lawyered up. They were able to apparently pull some strings in Washington. That's at least what some people believe. And after years of litigation, that company basically was able to settle for you know pennies on the dollar of the what the IRS originally believed was hundreds of millions of dollars that they owed. So the government was able to get some money out of that case. But for you know some of the people who were watching that closely, who were kind of hoping for a bigger government win, there was some disappointment there.
You mentioned that it was Biden who wanted to strengthen the IRS and put forward $80 billion to do it. The agency got that money in part to target the super wealthy and the largest corporations. And now, of course, we have Donald Trump who's saying, you know, he wants to blow out the enforcement of tax exemption against churches. And I'm wondering if, in your looking at the IRS, If this kind of whiplash between administrations has precedent, is it common to say, well, the Democrats will always do this when they're in, the Republicans will always do that when they're in, or is this precedent setting?
This seems pretty precedent setting to me. The IRS started losing a lot of funding under the administration of George W. Bush. That funding really did not fare well under the Obama administration. The IRS kind of continuously suffered for those 8 years. And then it got this infusion of new cash, which was itself unprecedented under Biden 3 years ago. And now, you know, the agency is being, its workforce is being slashed with a speed that I don't think has been seen before, or at least certainly not in recent memory.
What's your anticipation of what's going to get cut with these new layoffs? You have an article that we can point to. The IRS unit that audits billionaires has lost 38% of its employees since January. New data shows that's posted at ICIJ.org. And within that article, you say current agents in the high wealth unit describe their teams as being in a state of near paralysis as management contends with lost agents, stray audits, and uncertainty over the Trump administration's talk of additional layoffs. So now that we've moved a little beyond that, is there any indication that that same unit is going to be disproportionately targeted again?
You know, it depends exactly how they go about any additional layoffs. And those, you know, additional layoffs, it's at least reporting, has indicated that they are coming in the near future. You know, the layoffs so far have had a disproportionate effect on the offices that police billionaires and large corporations. This is because they have mostly targeted probationary employees. These are new employees in the IRS that have been working for mostly 1 year or less. Because the high wealth division of the IRS was a hiring priority over the past couple of years, it was filled with these probationary employees. These, just because they're called probationary employees, does not mean that they weren't very experienced. There was a big push also to specifically hire extremely experienced and accomplished tax professionals from the private sector. So a lot of these probationary employees were anything but newbies. They had a lot of them had come into the office with decades of private sector experience at big four accounting firms and big tax law firms and corporate jobs and enforcement jobs and stuff like that. So not only did the IRS and especially its high wealth division lose a lot of agents in these probationary firings, they lost a lot of highly skilled agents that the agency itself has been very desperate to get a hold of.
Spencer Woodman, investigative journalist for ICIJ.org. Spencer, it's such an indication of your chops as an investigative reporter that you were able to get people in such near terrified group of employees that you were able to get some of them to talk to you. And I just wanted to give you kudos for that and thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So we move on now to talk specifically about tax exemptions for churches and other religious organizations. If you're just joining us, we're focusing on whether those exemptions are abused. A 1954 rule forbids religious groups from politicking at risk of losing their exemption. Now, Trump promised during his first administration to remove that rule, which is widely ignored by activist churches. We have two superb guests to parse through that with us. Lloyd Hitoshi Meyer of the University of Notre Dame and Rachel Lazar of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. Lloyd is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame's Law School. He focuses on advocacy by nonprofit organizations, the intersection of election law and tax law with respect to lobbying and other political activity, federal and state regulation of nonprofits as well, including churches and religious organizations. Welcome to Your Call, Lloyd.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Lazarus, President and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, its first non-Christian and female leader in its 78-year history. She's a Harvard grad, lawyer, advocate, and strategist. She's written op-eds for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and appeared on MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, and more. Also on her resume, the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, Third Way, the National Women's Law Center, and the board of NARAL Pro-Choice America, which is now Reproductive Freedom for All. Rachel, so glad to have you as well.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So I did give a brief history of church tax exemptions at the beginning of the show. Wikipedia says the Johnson Amendment, which in 1954 restricted this political activism, was no big deal when it passed. There were no serious protests, not even commentary. And I've looked around and Wikipedia seems to have that right. So let's pull it apart a little bit. And to you first on this, Lloyd, which religious entities are tax exempt and what specifically aren't they allowed to do politically?
So any religious organization that's organized as a nonprofit can generally claim tax exempt status and charity status, which means they're eligible to receive tax deductible contributions. Of course, that says it's not limited to religious groups. It applies to charities, educational groups generally, religious or secular. But they share those benefits in common. What's different for churches is that churches enjoy certain procedural protections which are unique to them. And by churches, I mean churches of all religious faiths.
So the rule against political advocacy applies to, well, all tax-exempt charities. So how is that different for religious organizations?
That's right. The so-called Johnson Amendment was simply added to both the tax exemption for charities and the eligibility to receive tax-deductible contributions, and so it applies to secular and religious groups. But it's an absolute prohibition. It prohibits any use of resources or platforms of a charity, including a religious group, for political advocacy, that is supporting or opposing a candidate for elected public office. So that includes, most notably, and perhaps what is most grating for a lot of churches, the ability of a pastor in the pulpit on a Sunday morning or Saturday or Friday to endorse a candidate and otherwise speak about who the members of the congregation should vote for or against, even if they feel that such instruction is important to make for moral or theological reasons.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, it was, as I mentioned, no big deal when the Johnson Amendment passed, but it's a big deal now. It was 2017 when Donald Trump threatened to eliminate it, took his metaphorical big black marker and said, I'm going to get rid of this. Now, apparently he hasn't done anything about that yet. But there are plenty of churches and affiliated organizations who ignore it anyway. So who is pushing the rules? Who is in favor of it? And who's just flat out ignoring it?
Yeah, I mean, for one, there is a sweeping majority of Americans who are in favor of the Johnson Amendment. This one, like of all of our issues of church state, is the big unifier, right? And so during the first Trump administration, when he, as you said, set out to, quote, destroy the Johnson Amendment, more than 4,500 faith leaders, 5,500 nonprofit organizations, and 106 religious and denominational organizations weighed in to strongly oppose weakening or repealing the Johnson Amendment. And that's still true today. So, but if you, you know, look behind the curtain to who's really behind these efforts to destroy the Johnson Amendment, it is religious extremists and Christian nationalist organizations. It's groups like Alliance Defending Freedom and the Family Research Council. And you know, it's groups that have been on a rampage, frankly, throughout this country to get power and money for just a few of us, you know, ultra-conservative Christians and some religious extremists from all denominations at the expense of all of us. That's who's driving this campaign.
Well, let's get into exactly what qualifies as political activism. Lloyd, I take this to you. Let's be granular for just a minute. We get into the intersection of belief and political advocacy. If I, as a matter of my religion, if I believe women are out there killing babies on the regular, how far can I go advancing that idea within my church-related organizations, without stepping over the line into politicizing it?
So it's important to make a distinction here between talking about issues, talking about legislation, and talking about candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Churches and other religious groups and secular charities as well are free to talk about public policy issues, to criticize public officials for their positions or praise them for them. When it comes to legislation, all charities, including religious ones, are prohibited from engaging in too much lobbying. No one knows quite how much is too much, but they're allowed to talk a little bit. So, you know, I commonly get asked by reporters about, well, this church is speaking out about this bill or about this ballot initiative. And the answer is, well, they can do that as long as it's not too much of what they do. And usually that's not an issue for a church. Churches do lots of other things, of course. But then there's candidates. And that's where the Johnson Amendment kicks in. No charity that's tax exempt, including any church or other religious organization, is supposed to be able to support or oppose a candidate for elected public office. That's everything from formally endorsing a candidate to maybe giving them free use of space while not giving that opportunity to their opponents, to maybe giving subtler expression of support, praying for a candidate but not the other candidate, or perhaps inviting them to the stage and not inviting the other person to the stage. Now, I should note, well, I agree with the other guests that the people pushing for the destruction of the Johnson Amendment or modification of it are definitely on the conservative side of the aisle. One group that has been mostly on the progressive side of the aisle that's long at least pushed against the prohibition has been black, predominantly black churches. I actually sat once on a panel with a black minister, and when we discussed this issue, he said he was going to ignore the prohibition. And he's not alone in that. There have been studies that show a lot of black congregations, because they are the political heart of their communities often, as well as the social and religious heart, they feel it's part of their mission to help their congregations know who to support, and if members of the congregation are running for office, to support them as well, regardless of whether the IRS might show up or not.
Got it. Rachel, I want to take what Lloyd was saying there about the difference between advocacy and actually endorsing a candidate. I found an interesting case in that, particularly since we tend to talk about the right wing here. I found what the Unitarian Universalists talk about when they say how far they can go. And they say we are prophetic as opposed to political, we mean we loudly and proudly speak and organize around our values, working to advance voting rights, democracy, the rights of LGBTQA plus people, reproductive freedom, climate justice, and all EU justice priorities. We do this by nurturing engagement without urging support or opposition to candidates. So it sounds like they've got the line pretty much established to the point that this is information they share with their various churches around the country. I'm wondering if you have seen across the political spectrum, perhaps on the left, also issues to kind of disembowel the Johnson Amendment.
You know, so for one, I fully agree with Lloyd and with the Unitarian Universalists that it is completely, and I'll put this in quotations, kosher to argue for or against an issue. And, you know, that's very proper. When I used to work for the Reform Jewish movement, we used to give that guidance to our synagogues. And I'll add one more thing, which is that clergy, when they're not wearing their official clergy hat, right, at their house of worship, as private citizens can also take positions on candidates, right, like on their Facebook page, or so long as they're not doing it in their official capacity. You know, but what we're talking about here is really a benefit from the government, which is you don't have to pay, or there's tax exemption for people who donate to you. And the reason that you're getting that is because you have a mission that we've decided is advancing the common good, you know, in some sense. And what people giving to those entities don't want is to worry that politicians are going to come along and corrupt that mission. Right. So there's public trust that when they donate to these groups that are deemed worthy of being tax exempt, that they're not going to all of a sudden, you know, have a church turn into a PAC. Mm-hmm. Right. And no one really wants that. So as to what you and Lloyd were, what you were asking about, what Lloyd was saying about black churches, there have absolutely been violations that have happened, you know, on the quote progressive side. And I'll just say that when Americans United for Separation of Church and State, my organization, reports such violations, we report them in a very fair-handed way. Right, we report them on all sides, but I have not seen denominations are in could have missed it, but actually arguing for getting rid of the Johnson Amendment. And again, who's leading that fight out there is currently also the Trump administration and Trump himself, but also these groups that are notoriously white Christian nationalist leaders in our country that are leading the charge against LGBTQ people and fighting for turning religious freedom on its head into a license to discriminate, and who are trying to impose religion into our public schools across the country. And, you know, in this case, we're really talking about getting rid of something that everyone wants because it keeps your house of worship unified. And I just want to make that one last point. We are living in such divided times, right? No one would disagree with that. And our houses of worship, you know, are places where we can go and seek out unity and friendship and not worry about politics, right? We can put politics in that sense aside, and that keeps religion protected and make sure that these strings that are attached with benefits, right, don't warp our religious views in any way. And I'll just say, look what's happening at universities across the country, right? We don't want houses of worship to worry about making deals with the government because they're worried about losing you know, benefits that from the government. That's really important for houses of worship.
There's a tangent we don't have time to go into, but I encourage those of you who are listening to look for a conversation with Rachel online where she talked about why the separation of church and state is actually good for religious freedoms as opposed to oppressing it. So I encourage you to look for that on YouTube. Not hard to find. I'm Angie Cordova, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Rachel Lazler is with Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. Lloyd Hitoshi Meyer with the University of Notre Dame. We would like your contributions to this conversation. Our phone lines are open for your questions and comments. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also drop us an email if you prefer not to go on the air. We're watching for that at yourcall@kalw.org. I wonder how much you're following the issue of the religious tax exemptions, whether they're enforced, whether they'll be eliminated. Do you have any particular feelings about that? 866-798-8255. Or your call at kalw.org. We're up for a quick break here, then right back to the topic. I'm Angie Cuero. This is Your Call.
So I would say that the Family Research Council is a political advocacy group. I'm not sure they would even deny that label. And they what they did was they applied to the IRS for recognition not as a church or house of worship, but as an association or convention of churches. And this was a category that Congress created primarily to deal with how to handle denominations and denominational bodies that maybe themselves didn't have congregations, but were formed in order to support a particular subset of churches or houses of worship. But the problem, as my co-author Ellen April and I pointed out, is that while Congress was thinking a single denomination, your body that supports the churches of a single denomination, the IRS, we believe mistakenly, interpreted it as applying to any group that supported houses of worship, even ones from multiple denominations. And so the Family Research Council went into the IRS and said, look, we've got a lot of church members. Now, they're not all part of the same denomination by any stretch. They share some, obviously, conservative theological similarities, but they're not the same denomination. But we're a group of these churches, and therefore we should qualify. And that gives us all the same tax benefits as not only a charity, but a church, which exempts us from a bunch of government filings, makes it harder for the IRS to audit us. And the IRS eventually agreed and gave them that status. And, you know, to be fair, under the law as it is, they may have been right to argue for that. But I think, in my co-author Ellen April, the law of Los Angeles also thinks that the IRS got the definition of that term wrong. And that's a problem.
Yeah, let me go back on that. And just to clarify, it sounds like they were using what already existed or didn't exist in the law. And what they managed to do along the way is kind of make new law. Is that accurate?
It's not necessarily a new law. There have been other groups. World Vision, for example, qualifies as an association or convention of churches. The Evangelical Council of Financial Accountability does as well. And again, they base it on the fact that our members, in some sense, are a bunch of churches. And again, not the same denomination, which we think was Congress's original intent for that category. But we can reasonably claim that these are our members, these churches, and we should have this status. I should note that this is different than what Focus on the Family did. Focus on the Family earlier did claim church status based on the fact that, though, again, they seem to be an advocacy group, an educational group, they have worship meetings of their employees, and they use that status to try to claim church status. The IRS actually pushed back against them, mm-hmm. But then they brought in some, frankly, a high-powered law firm, and that law firm pushed back hard, and at that point, the IRS decided not to fight the issue. And gave them the church status. That, I think, is more questionable because they are not a church in the sort of conventional sense I think anyone would agree on. And yet, because they have to show, our employees get together every morning or whatever to pray, to worship, that makes us a church, even though most, of course, what we do in the day doesn't look like what a church does.
Got it. Rachel, let's talk about Americans United for Separation of Church and State. What particular groups have you had in your sights that are really skirting the law here or trying to gain that exemption more as a political stance than anything else?
Right. I mean, I was just going to talk about sort of the deal when you qualify as a church, but you're really, you know, a political group that you just get out of a ton of accountability and transparency. And I just wanted to really emphasize that. So houses of worship, you know, as Lloyd was saying, they don't have to file 990s, that 501c3s like Americans United have to file. And people can sort of look into, you know, what your highest paid employees make, et cetera, right? There's a lot on there, how much money you've made in the year, right? You automatically get tax exemption if you're a house of worship. And you know what? Today, with what DOGE has done to agencies like the IRS, that's a benefit, you know? Mm-hmm. The IRS also has limited ability to audit houses of worship. So again, less accountability, less transparency. Many states exempt houses of worship from having to pay unemployment taxes, right? So you're talking about being able to get around the social safety net, right, more and more when groups that aren't really churches are claiming to be. So that's our concern, and it's a dangerous path, again, one that we're seeing blazed by the white Christian nationalist groups.
Well, let's talk about what it means to be exempt from some of the regulations, because so much of what's done by these organizations, they don't have to report. So, for example, if I were a church or religious organization and I hired a number of employees who under state or local law would have to be covered with health insurance. Is that kind of thing examined with the churches, or can they just, you know, flout that and get away with it because it's done in the dark? That's to you, Rachel.
I'll let Lloyd actually start by answering that one.
Okay, Lloyd.
So first thing, Rachel's exactly right about the benefits that churches and other houses of worship enjoy, both under federal law and usually under state law as well. Now, what benefit laws apply, that's going to vary a lot. One of the big issues, though, is retirement plans. The Wall Street Journal actually had an article highlighting how the fact that churches and church affiliate entities like hospital systems are able to avoid the application of federal ERISA law relating to retirement plans has created huge problems for the employees, because the point of ERISA is to make sure that those retirement plans are fully funded, that the workers get what's been promised to them, and churches can exempt themselves from all those rules, and sometimes that comes back and bites the employees. So that's an example of where there's a big hole in benefit law coverage for church affiliate plans. And that hole has been taken advantage of, again, not just by churches and denominational bodies, but by church affiliate entities like major hospital systems. And that's problematic. So I think Rachel's exactly right. The more groups are shoehorned their way into this status, the less accountability you have and the more blind spots you have. Now, to be fair, I think a lot of the conservative Christian groups that have shoehorned their way into the status, they are simply suspicious of government oversight. And they're not necessarily doing anything nefarious without that accountability. But they've blazed the trail, as Rachel said, which means other groups, perhaps ones with less principled motives, will also follow that trail and may use it to hide illegal activity, improper diversion of charitable funds, and so on, without the accountability that the Form 990 annual return to the IRS enforces on other tax-exempt organizations.
You know, if we look at churches that aren't audited by the IRS, we're looking at the federal laws that we've been discussing. Among those laws is a requirement that high-level treasury officials, quote unquote, reasonably believe the church or association has violated federal tax rules before they can actually start an investigation. And this is a fully structured IRS. Pre-cuts, actual people who actually work there, which we're going to see fewer and fewer of. So, to your knowledge, Lloyd, I'll stay with you on this. To your knowledge, how often does the investigation of a church or religious organization actually happen?
So we only have anecdotal information because IRS doesn't publish statistics on this, but it seems pretty clear from the anecdotal information, including information from practitioners, that it's very rare for the IRS to audit a church because of this requirement. You have to have a relatively senior official. It's not even clear how senior they have to be. There's been litigation about that. Sign off on this based on personal belief. Well, these people are busy. Even if they're inclined to sign off on these, they only have so much time in the day. And so the church has to have been clearly broken the law before they even start their investigations. There has to be some sort of other evidence, a news report, some other information the IRS has received. So again, I think it's very rare for churches to be audited. And it tends to happen sometimes in the most egregious situations where it's a fake church, it's really a tax shelter, or perhaps where money's being stolen hand over fist. But it's very rare, and it's particularly rare for the political activity we're talking about here, because that situation is not only means someone has to sign off on it at a very high level, but also it's politically risky. The IRS, the last thing the IRS commissioner wants to have to do, especially when we finally have someone besides an acting commissioner, is be hauled in front of a committee of Congress to explain why this church or that church was audited. And so they'd prefer, frankly, and I think most IRS employees would prefer, not to go into this area even to enforce the Johnson Amendment just because it's too politically risky and it creates too much political exposure and backlash, which they already have more than enough of to handle.
But Angie, can I add to
Yeah,
that? This is
please.
Rachel.
Sure.
And Lloyd, I mean, I agree with that. There's we don't know. We don't know, but we suspect that there's not been a lot of enforcement. But I will say that just the existence of the Johnson Amendment and knowing that it's there and been there for over 70 years enables organizations like mine, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, to send like pre-litigation, pre-enforcement, notification letters to houses of worship when we see or are notified of violations of the Johnson Amendment. And that has some power, right? Even where the IRS hasn't been as active, to put it mildly, under many administrations as we think, we wish they would have been, it still carries power to be able to write those letters. And we have sent those letters, over many years. And again, we've done it in a very fair-handed way. We sent one, we know in 1992, this obviously predates my time at Americans United, about a church in Binghamton, New York, the church at Pierce Creek, that violated the Johnson Amendment. And it actually lost its tax-exempt status after it ran newspaper ads telling people not to vote for Bill Clinton for president. Someone who works at Americans United, Rob Boston, who's just incredible, has been here for over 35 years. He remembers that there were a few cases where the IRS issued sanctions that stopped short of revocation, and those made it to the airwaves, which they often don't. So, like a New York pastor had endorsed Al Gore from the pulpit in 2000, and then he later said in a media interview that he received a warning from the IRS and had to sign a document stating that he would not do it again. So I do think, again, we don't really know what goes on behind the scenes. We suspect that there's not a lot that seems to have, that kind of more lackadaisical enforcement seems to have sort of started happening more around the turn of the century. And we're not sure why, But what we are sure of is who's driving this effort right now to try to destroy the Johnson Amendment is very openly the Trump administration and a lot of religious extremist groups that would like to corrupt churches and basically turn them into an arm of the Republican Party. And that's problematic for houses of worship and for religion because it puts them at grave risk of being influenced by the government. And as Dr. King said, that the church should be the conscience of the state, and it can't be if it's controlled by the government.
That's Rachel Lazar, President and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. We also have with us Lloyd Hitoshi Meyer, President, Professor. I just made you President, Lloyd. Professor of Law at the University of Notre Dame's Law School. Lloyd, I wonder if you can cite for us any cases that you have seen go down where it just was egregiously wrong. Where you have seen a church or a religious organization flat out endorse a candidate, flat out tell people how to vote, and when it was challenged, they came out okay. Do you know of any such cases?
So, there's some question. I'm familiar with the Church of Pierce Creek Branch Ministries case where the IRS did revoke tax exempt status, so it's unclear how long that revocation lasted. But there was also a case in 2004 where there was All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California, that a retired rector gave a sermon involving a debate between Bush, Kerry, and Jesus on the weekend before the general election. Let's just say Bush came out a little worse in that debate than Kerry did. And the IRS audited that church and said they had violated the rule, and the church actually decided to fight it. And they fought it for a couple of years. Full disclosure, my law firm was involved in representing them when I was in private practice, so I wasn't personally involved. And the IRS eventually dropped the audit, saying that the church had done what Rachel mentioned happened in that other case, which is, oh, they said they admit they did it wrong and they won't do it again. The church took the position publicly, they had said no such thing, that they wanted to fight this all the way. But the IRS didn't penalize them, and without any penalty, there's no way to get to court. So they seem to have gotten away with something, arguably. The other thing I'd mention is something Rachel mentioned, which is the religious community is divided on this because a lot of pastors want to be in the position, and rabbis and imams want to be in the position to be able to tell perhaps the partisan zealots in their own congregations, look, I can't do anything from the pulpit. I'm not allowed to. It's against the law. And that way they're able to create the unity that Rachel mentioned, not create the divisions, which most congregations want to avoid. And the Johnson Amendment gives them a shield to use when someone comes to them, or even a campaign comes to them, as happened with the George W. Bush campaign once, comes to them to try to get them involved politically. They can raise the Johnson Amendment and say, I can't do that, which it turns out is in the interest of their congregation at the end of the day.
It's interesting that you bring up the moral considerations, people actually trying to adhere to the law within organizations that may not be doing exactly that. And it goes to something that Paul Krugman put out today. He titled his newsletter Happy Tax Evasion Day. And he said lax tax collection has a moral as well as a financial cost because it specifically rewards bad behavior. It takes us down a road toward a society where anyone who plays by the rules is a chump. A Leona Helmsley society in which only the little people pay taxes. Wealth evaders are their kind of people, Trump and Musk. Taxes, declared Oliver Wendell Holmes, are what we pay for civilized society. But these days, barbarians are in control. Rachel, since Lloyd brings up the churches that are doing it right, or at least the individuals within the organizations that are doing it right, I wonder what you've encountered along the same line, finding not the barbarians, but the people who are doing this morally.
We're doing it morally. Americans United for Separation of Church and State is a tax-exempt organization. We're a 501c3. We have 4 stars from Charity Navigator. We have platinum transparency on GuideStar, and we're accredited by the Better Business Bureau, right? I mean, I think the deal is that, churches get so many benefits, right? We listed them out earlier. And, in this one case, we're asking them if you want the benefit of tax exemption, you have to do this one thing. It's not that hard. I mean, we do it too, right? Which is like, you can't be directly partisan. That's it. You can do issue advocacy, as much as your heart desires, you know? And, you know, we're just asking houses of worship to take seriously the public trust that charitable donations go to charitable use, and they should honor that. And Angie, just one more thing. I'm glad that you brought up this sort of moral question. I think it's really interesting, and I actually think it is morality that we're talking about when we're talking about those who are opposing the Johnson Amendment, because they want getting rid of the Johnson Amendment. It would create an enormous loophole for political donations, and it drags churches into it. It's like Citizens United on steroids, right? And you know, we don't want houses of worship to launder political contributions, right? Churches would be unaccountable, right? There'd be this black hole. And the point is, we have entities for becoming politically involved, and they're political action committees, right? But the point is, by and large, like the vast majority of Americans don't want their churches to become PACs. Right. So we are talking about not creating these enormous loopholes for political donations and dark money.
One of the things that you endorse, Lloyd, is changing the definition of who qualifies for this kind of exemption. And you're mentioning the fact that maybe a church is an entity that actually performs church services. That seems pretty simple. But what else, under fair rules, would a tax-exempt, how would it, a tax-exempt institution or church, what else do you suggest they would have to, how would they have to conduct themselves? What would they have to do to retain that exemption in an ideal situation?
Well, just to be clear, you don't have to be a church to get the exemption. All you have to be is religious. I'm sitting in the University of Notre Dame, which is educational, but obviously a religious institution. It's a charity, but it has the accountability that other tax organizations have. It files an I-90. It had to file an application with the IRS to get that status, and so on. So I think the issue of whether you should have these special procedural protections, well, what are they designed for? They're designed to protect the development of congregations that are at the heart of every religious faith and even secular movements. There are secular groups that qualify technically as churches because they're about raising up and training people on how to live your life in a moral way. And so that's really what a church should predominantly be about. It shouldn't be predominantly about providing a secular education. So University of Notre Dame should not be a church. It shouldn't be predominantly about providing health services. So hospitals shouldn't be churches. It should be organizations that are at the heart of a religious faith community that are designed to raise up and gather people together to honor that faith. Now that's hard because religious traditions vary a lot. And so what looks like a group like that for a Christian group or a Jewish group might not look like that for a Buddhist group or a Hindu group. So there is some difficulty making those definitions in a way that's fair to all religious faiths, but I think that's the heart of it. It's the gathering of the people together in order to learn about their faith, follow their faith, engage in sacraments, worship, and so forth.
I'm going to be taking this same question over to Rachel. So hold that thought, Rachel, because we do have a call coming in, and I want to squeeze it in. Maurice, we're tight to the end of the show, but can you go ahead with your question, and we'll get to that as best we can.
Yes, Angie, this is not a question. It's a commentary on the nature of God, faith, and religion. When you speak of these subjects, you're presupposing something that's not in evidence. And if it's not in evidence, it's based on something I find fraudulent, inaccurate, and a canard. And I say further commentary that once life is discovered elsewhere in the universe, religion, faith, and God will be relegated to the ash heap of history where it belongs. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that, Maurice. And Rachel, I want to take this to you with. I want to emphasize Americans United for the Separation of Church and State does not take the view that religion is a bad thing, that it will be relegated to an ash heap. You're asking that these two things be kept sacrosanct, so to say, that religions are this thing and government is that thing.
Angie, thank you so much for this opportunity to clarify. Americans United for Separation of Church and State brings religious and non-religious Americans together every day to fight in the courts, in Congress, and across state legislatures, and also in the public square for everyone's freedom to believe as they choose and to live as themselves. And we were founded by primarily Methodist Christians in Chicago clergy, along with the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, Seventh-day Adventists, and seminary deans. Today on our board, we have a Latino, a white, and a Black Baptist pastor. We have a Black United Church of Christ pastor. We have an Orthodox Jewish leader who's a woman. We have an atheist leader. And we take so much pride in bringing together, right, in such divided times, mm-hmm. Americans who are religious with who are non-religious. And I'll say that when Americans United hired me as the first Jewish leader and the first non-Christian leader of the group in our almost 80-year existence, you know, I said, I told my parents, you know, I got this job or whatever, and they said, gosh, I really hope there aren't just a bunch of Jewish people working there. And I said, don't worry about it. There are actually very few. And of our 50, we have a ton of Christians who are working with us and, you know, people of all different backgrounds and beliefs. And that's really the beauty of church-state separation. It is what guarantees religious freedom. It is what stops religion from being sullied or influenced by the government. And also it's what protects taxpayers' religious freedom so that, you know, take what's happening in our public schools across the country and, you know, the imposition of one Protestant version of the Ten Commandments in classrooms or a Bible-infused curriculum for elementary school kids in Texas, just to name a few examples.
Rachel, I'm so sorry. I got to cut you off there. I'm so sorry, but the clock has caught us. That's Rachel Lazar of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. Thanks, too, to Lloyd Hitoshi Meyer of the University of Notre Dame. You can email your show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for doing that. Nina Kissinger helped produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. Rose Aguilar comes back tomorrow. I'm Angie Cuero. It's Your Call.